Welcome. I hope you're all well. Thank you for joining me on this Sunday evening. We'll ease ourselves into the live stream so, you know, a few people can gather. But I'm sure you all watched the fights last night. Lots to talk about. It was very fun. Some good fights, some interesting fights, some talking points. Just kind of general talking points from MMA at the moment, really. Like movement in the rules and stuff. Like we're hearing about California potentially, considering doing something about the downed opponent rule, which I think is interesting. I'm going to talk about that a bit today, as well as some of other things that I think MMA could potentially benefit from. But yeah, we're having a bit of a chilled one. We've just recorded the War Room for this weekend's card coming up. Jack Hermanson, of course, is going to be always fun to watch, taking on Joe Pyfer. So that War Room will be dropping, what, Monday, Jamie, maybe? Yeah, tomorrow. So there is that. And then what else? That was something I was going to talk to you about, Jamie. We need to figure out, what's the situation with playing music on the channel? Like, can we do we get in trouble for it? Do they, like, stop us? Do they, oh, that's a shame. You'll notice my new Megadeth t-shirt. I realised that I've had a Megadeth t-shirt every year of my life since I was, like, 12 years old, and I don't have one right now, and so I quickly got an order in. So, you digging my new Megadeth t-shirt. Before we get onto the UFC, before we get onto that, I just want to draw everybody's attention to Ben Whittaker, who boxed last night. My goodness, what a performance. So if you go into my stories, you'll see some of the highlights from his fight. He's very early in the beginning of his pro career. He was a silver medalist at the Olympics. Very, very skilled striker, moves incredibly well. Kept getting told off yesterday for showboating. Spinning around on one foot and stuff, but the way that he was able to move around and manipulate his opponent was fantastic. So do watch that. It got me thinking today about, you know, showboating and trash talking, and, you know, like where is the line drawn? You know, because a lot of it is down to, certainly for the trash talking, like there are some referees that just never seem to bother, and there are other referees, if you say anything, they're like, yeah, don't say anything. So I'm kind of interested to know what your guys' thoughts are on showboating and trash talking. The highlight that you'll see of Ben Whittaker, you'll see the referee telling him off. But the reality is, if you can do it and get away with it, maybe you should be able to, because that's the kind of stuff that people want to watch. You know, like people to be able to do incredible things in high pressure situations, right? That's why the more high stakes the fight, the more interested we are. And when someone can walk into a really high stakes situation, like any kind of professional sporting context, really, and make it look so easy. And then you've got the argument of, you know, like the psychological tactics, not only entertaining the people watching, but also like, aggravating his opponent and drawing, provoking them, drawing them out of their show. Because although this, you know, this is very specific to this fight, one other thing that I noticed, the end of the round after Ben Whittaker had done this little showboat and spun and the beautiful uppercut, when his opponent got back to his corner, his coach wasn't there because he was talking to the referee. So there was even sort of a 15 seconds or so that the fighter was not getting any advice in the corner. And that was a result of the showboating. So, you know, kind of a dual benefit there. But I thought it was fantastic. Definitely, if you get the opportunity to watch it. Khalid Gradia. Not very good with names. Ben Whittaker. Go and search it. It's on Sky Sports Boxing's YouTube channel. Really something quite special. And so he's trained by a guy called Joby Clayton, who also coaches at Renegade. And, you know, to watch him step onto the mat and coach Muay Thai to a bunch of MMA fighters is really, really quite incredible. So, you know, definitely going to be following Ben Whittaker's career for sure. Certainly one to watch out for. Okay, right. Let's start having a look at the UFC card. I'll be honest, I kind of scan watched the first couple. They were a little bit slow. I'm starting to find I'm like, I kind of, I don't know, maybe it's because I just watch a lot of fights all the way through the week. You know, if ever I'm looking at signing a fighter, I need to make sure I've watched a couple of three of their fights so I know what kind of fighter they are. I've got shows coming up that I'm researching for as well. So, you know, I'm always watching stuff. So, like, when I find a fight that's kind of slow going, I tend to have to revisit it and really focus and sit and go, okay, give this your attention because, you know, these guys are giving their best. The first fight on the card that really stood out that I thoroughly enjoyed was Luana Carolina against Dolly Arenko. It was a bit of a messy, chaotic fight. It was quite sloppy at times, but like there were so many moments where I was like Dolly Arenko is gonna steal this with this armbar or this triangle, and Luana Carolina, I mean, she just toughed it out. She was able to get the finish 8 seconds before the end of the fight. One thing I will say though is what she was what 3 pounds overweight, so at 126 and she was 129. Like there's got to be something done about it. There's got to be something done about these fighters that miss weight because there is an advantage there, and you've got to think that, you know, what is 3 pounds on weigh-in day could potentially be a lot more on fight day, and in those clinch situations, in those ground exchanges, that extra bit of weight, you know, it might have cost you the day before and it might come out of your purse, but you might be benefiting from it on the night and you still get the win on the record. So that's something that I think needs to be addressed. It kind of brings me onto a bit of a bigger topic anyway, because I was making a few notes while I was watching the fights last night, because I feel like there are some things that, you know, with California raising the conversation about the downed opponent rule, I kind of feel like there are a few things that we could look at in mixed martial arts that we could maybe wonder whether they're still applicable to mixed martial arts in the 21st century. Obviously, the obvious one being the downward elbows rule, because it's such a very specific elbow, right? And you now are starting to see fighters step out and try things that are close but not quite. Like we've seen the Travis Brown elbows ground and pound where they're kind of coming in at a weird angle. Like the reality is, it's a 12 to 6 elbow that's illegal, right? So as long as I'm not doing that, I'm all right. I don't think I'd be able to do nearly as much damage with that as I would a proper clean elbow. And I can't think of a position where I would be able to use that, or I would prefer to use it over another elbow. Like even when John Jones got disqualified against Matt Hamill for the downward elbow, it was still an unusual technique for him to choose to use anyway. And, you know, you can still argue there was an angle on that as well. Like, it's very difficult to throw a very, very straight 12 to 6 elbow. So then if we're going, well, there's a variance. I mean, you know, what was that? Was that like what time is that? Is that like 1 to 5 or, you know, maybe it's 1 to 7, wouldn't it? See, I've got Jamie, he's got a digital phone. He's not even paying attention. He's like, digital clocks, they're ruining us. Yeah, you know you know what I'm saying, though? Like, the angle only needs to change slightly, and then all of a sudden it becomes a legal elbow. And it's the same thing with the downed fighter, right? What is it? Is it weight-bearing? Is it a fingertip? Like, do you have to have a full palm or a closed fist? Like, because the conversation, that, from what I understand for California, is that they're talking about it having to be either an elbow/forearm or a knee on the floor. So then you look at the main event from last night with that beautiful kick to the face that Imovov landed. And I don't mind that technique. You know, he landed it earlier in the night and Imovov didn't have his fingertips on the canvas and it was absolutely fine. The biggest problem with these rules is that it puts the fighter in a position where they have to really pay attention in that moment to a specific angle of a strike. It's an unusual thing to have to really focus on in a fight situation. Like, is the person's fingertips down? Is my fist exactly above my elbow when I'm throwing this strike? Like, the elbow is not effective enough to be able to have it completely illegal. So it's not effective enough to really put that confusion in the fighter's mind as to whether, is this going to be a downward elbow or not? Like, even referees don't even seem to be pulling fighters up on elbows that are kind of borderline. So, you know, as long as you're not striking to an illegal target back of the head of the spine, I don't really see how it matters what kind of elbow it is. And then when it comes to the downed opponent thing, like, you know, you go back to the Peter Jan Aljamain Sterling situation. We had the Arnold Allen situation the other week. We had, of course, Imavov and Dolidze last night. Like, all of those situations could have been nullified by just making that rule very, very clear. And I don't mind if a fighter has their hand down. Like, I was a big fan of Pride rules, right? And I know the reason people don't like the full Pride rules is because soccer kicks and stomps to the head. I totally hear you. As a purist, I don't really mind it, personally. I'm not really that bothered. Like, the less rules, the better. As long as we're not eye gouging and fish hooking and intentionally striking to the groin as well as the back of the head and spine. Like, we can kind of protect the really, really important targets of the body. Everything else should be fair game. Like, even like the oblique kick, the chasse kick to the knee, I know people don't like it, but for me, it's a part of combat sports. It's a part of martial arts. And the point of MMA for me was always to get as close to a real kind of bring your skill set and see what works best kind of scenario. The more rules and the more stringent we are, the more it starts to, I don't know. It doesn't suit me. I think we're moving in the right direction with the California Commission assessing that rule, and I do think that it would make life a lot easier for the fighters if it was way clearer. Like, if a knee's down or an elbow's down, that's a lot easier to recognize because of the position of the fighter. This is why I keep going back to Peter Jan. I still feel like that was an intentional knee. Like, I just know if I'm leaning over somebody, if like the height of that person, whether they're on a knee or not. So anyway, that's a whole different subject. But I do hope we get some clarification on that. And you know, this kind of got me thinking, well, you know, what are the other things that we would change? Well, we had a load of eye pokes last night. We had a fight that didn't even get started because of an eye poke. Got to fix the gloves. I know they said they fixed the gloves. I don't believe it. I think the thing that changed about the gloves was the design on the back. It says 30 instead of UFC. That's the only thing that's changed about the gloves. I've got gloves from 2008 and I've got gloves from last year, and I can tell you that is the same model of glove. The only difference maybe is that the leather's a little bit softer and the design on the back of the glove is different. What's amazing is that almost every Friday now they have one Friday fights at Lumpini Stadium, and that is Muay Thai with small gloves. And those guys are always reaching out to like lock hands and grab and roll over for elbows and stuff. And I saw one eye poke the other day in one of their events. And I watched those most weeks, and it's very, very rare that I see eye pokes. Even in a sport where people are reaching to grab so much as they are in small gloves Muay Thai. But then you look at the ONE Championship gloves and they're the Fairtex ones. They curve nice. They keep the hand curved. So it's an effort to open your hand. Like, I felt bad for Randy Brown yesterday because he even had his palm up as he reached out. But the tendency of the gloves is still to pull your hand open. It would be much better if they were slightly more rounded. So I think there are certain things that we could put on the table that we could tweak and improve. Take away the downward elbows. That is just it makes no sense anymore. The downed opponent rule. I don't like hands and feet. I think a forearm or a knee, perfect. The gloves have got to be fixed. There are definitely better designs of gloves that encourage the hand to be more closed. And if there aren't, I'm not even going to say that because there are better gloves out there that will help prevent that happening. However, I will also say that the punishment needs to be better because people need to be far more conscious of what they're doing. Like, if it's just you get a timeout and don't do that again, you got to keep your blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. The person's still got a poked eye, a scratch on their retina or whatever. And I'm not going to mention anybody's names, but I've watched enough fight footage to recognize when people are flicking and poking and intentionally. There are always people that will play the rules and get away with what they can, which is why the weight making thing has got to be solved as well. I didn't actually realize this when I first started working for the PFL in Europe. The rule that we have is that if you miss weight in a regular season bout, if you're in the playoffs or the regular season, if you miss weight, you get a point deducted off the scorecards. Now, that doesn't go onto your official record. However, I do wonder what it would what it would do to the sport if we just changed it. Like, if you miss weight, if you're like 3-4 pounds overweight, and you know that you're going to lose a point off that scorecard in the first round, it puts far more pressure on you to win, and it puts you at a deficit in the actual fight where you've got the advantage from the weight. So, like, some people will sacrifice the 20% of their purse. Yeah, you can take that. I'll keep the extra couple of pounds on my frame and not murder myself in the weight cut, because I've still got the advantage of the weight advantage on fight day. I hope I'm making sense. I'm probably not. What was the other thing I was going to talk about? Oh yeah, that was something else that stood out last night as well. And this is something, it's maybe not quite as obvious, but if you look at stats, if you go into UFC stats, if you dig into the stats, control time is counted holding up against the fence as well. And this, I mean, this is kind of two topics. One is, you know, should that be counted as control? Because a lot of the time it for me seems like a stalling position, a holding position. Control is when you've already established top position. That's control. Like, you've got control of the person on the floor. Holding somebody up against the fence is, I don't feel like enough effort has gone into that to warrant being scored as control, especially if the person's not doing enough striking, right? It's almost like defense is the reward in itself, so you don't get scored for it. But, like, you could also say that about control up against the fence. Control up against the fence. If you're holding someone and you're not striking, you're not controlling, you're holding. If you're controlling someone up against the fence, that means that you're creating windows and opportunities to strike as well. So then that therefore can be scored as control. I mean, I'm just kind of throwing these random things out there. Yeah. I want to know your thoughts. I'll circle back to that a bit later in the night. I'll talk about the fights, because there are some really, really good ones that stood out. I've got to give Molly McCann a shout out. I mean, like, to go down, like, when she announced that she was going down to strawweight, I was concerned, because, like, the process of making weight for her, it always seemed like it was a necessary evil to be able to get in there and punch somebody in the face. And this is the first time I've seen her walk onto the scales looking like she is ready to compete like a professional athlete. And I just think it showed all the way through, you know, through her attitude and her performance. I thought her boxing defense looked a lot better. You know, you go back a couple of years and you watch her getting stuck in and swinging punches kind of wild. And then you look at that performance from last night and she's like, like lovely little covers and defensive maneuvers on the inside. And of course, you know, we saw the armbar, and you know, we saw her land that beautiful submission on Polaris a little while ago as well. This is a really interesting version of Molly McCann, especially in the strawweight division, where she can be ferocious and a real bully. So shout out to Molly. That was by far the best version that we've ever seen of her. Really, really impressive. Have a quick drink. Cheers, everybody. Welcome to Rum Sundays. Man, I felt sorry for Muradov. That was just mad unfortunate, wasn't it? Just, I was really excited for that fight. And I tell you what else as well. Randy Brown, Muslim Salikov. Now, Randy Brown was like, you could tell in his post-fight interview, he was like, right, if I get the mic, I'm going to say some things. I'm going to let you know. Because it was kind of almost letting go. He was almost doing the Moicano and just cuss and this and that and blah, blah, blah. But he was still a little bit Randy Brown. He was still a little bit reserved. I think in the next two or three fights of Randy Brown, we're going to see him really start to come into his own. That was a strong performance. Muslim Salikov, although obviously is, you know, is a little later in years for an MMA fighter at welterweight. He's the king of kung fu. He's a wicked striker. And even as the fight was going on, of course he's dealing with Randy Brown, who's longer and faster and just kind of generally slicker in his movement. There were still so many nice things that Muslim Salikov, little twists and turns on the inside. But the communication between Randy Brown and his corner team as well. Now that is when you know someone is vibing at the right level in mixed martial arts. When they're at that presence where they can go, yep, I got it. It was beautiful. And that little drift to the open side, we talk about it a lot, these quarter angles. You know, like I'm standing square against my opponent, we're in a 50-50 position. If I move slightly towards their open side or their closed side, I put them in a vulnerable position. And that's what he did with that jab, a little drift, bat, bat, poof, straight down. A lovely performance. I hope he gets the opportunities that he's asking for, because I feel like as the stakes increase and as the opponents get better, now he's at the position where he's going to rise and meet that challenge. And I think his post-fight interviews are going to get better and better. However, Renato Moicano, I mean, like, was that the best post-fight interview since the Nate Diaz famous, I'm not surprised. I mean, he just styled it all the way through. He was like, he had a rant, but he had a point to make, and he was passionate about it, and he was funny, and he was candid. And, you know, I just think he recruited so many fans, because, of course, like, the Brazilian fans are going to love him. But then the statements that he was making about America, like, you know, that fan base is going to really gravitate towards him, because I think a lot of people are feeling like he is at the moment. And I don't think it matters who's saying it, as long as they're speaking from the heart and speaking truth. And I thoroughly enjoyed that fight. It was a very smart performance from Moicano. Like, you watch the way that Drew Dober bounces in and out of range. And, like, even those first couple of exchanges where he's, like, so high on his toes, and then there was a little exchange, and Drew Dober just comes wading in with a ba, ba, ba. Just incredibly powerful individual. Like, there were some simple mistakes he made on the floor that I think could be tweaked and improved, and his scrambling ability is going to be so much better. The instinct to dig his underhook was not there enough, which is why he tended to get stuck in that position, taking nothing away from Moicano's ground game, top control. But it was interesting to see the decisions that Moicano was using to maintain top position. I think it was the last round, in fact, where Moicano he was in side control and he went back into half guard, and then started to work to mount. It was almost like he preferred that lower body control with just one leg. And I think by that point, he'd realized that Dober wasn't doing a very good job of getting on his side and digging his underhook. So, you know, because his hips were square and flat, it was easier to mount him from half guard by prying his legs open. Beautiful performance from Moicano. And, you know, I'm a big fan of both of these guys, and I feel like, you know, they're both going to be contenders in, you know, for the next couple of years in this division. I wouldn't be surprised if we see them fight again. And I also wouldn't be surprised if over five rounds the fight goes slightly differently as well. You know, there was a lot of blood coming out of Moicano. And this kind of goes back to something that came up the other week where I can't remember where the comment was. I don't tend to read comments too much, but it was you look at his face at the post-fight press conference. I'm like, this is a good example of you can't judge a fight by the faces of the opponents afterwards, because Dober did a number on him, and that's why I think over five rounds it might be a slightly different fight, especially now they've got that 15 minutes of knowledge of one another. It'd be interesting to see him go again. How are we doing, Jamie? If we've got questions, just shout up. Jamie's over there. You'll hear him from time to time. His stomach will growl, or his phone will beep or something.
That's why I've got my mic turned off at the minute.
I need to point out the new design that Jamie's done. We've done away with the inappropriate font on Aftermath. You'll see we've gone for a far more industrial vibe, which, to be honest, kind of goes with my, like I'm listening to a lot of metal at the moment. This has got a very kind of hardcore, like New York hardcore, you know, incendiary kind of vibe to it. I like it. I'm digging it.
Yeah, I felt like it suited the show a little better.
It does, yeah.
In the ectoplasm text. Wasn't the first remark, so I had to change it.
No. And it was ectoplasm, for anybody out there that was wondering. You know, I mean, you know, it was mystery design, that, right? And he likes a bit of a horror show, doesn't he? He's in Thailand at the moment. I saw him bobbing around in the sea with Lewis McGrillan.
Yeah, I think he's out there with Mokaev as well.
Oh, is he?
Doing some bits with him.
Lovely time.
Yeah. It looks like he's having a great time.
Pack him in your suitcase, mystery. Where's the Raptor case gone? It's gone.
Oh, yeah, I put it out.
Yeah, we've got a Raptor case. We used to fold him up into it. It's, you know, just put him in an overhead locker. It's fine. It's perfect. No, I'm really interested to see what content he gets, because I know he's been touring the gyms and he's had a lot of interesting things to tell me. So, yeah, I'm interested to see. And I'm interested to see what McGrillan looks like when he gets back from Thailand. Like, that is a kid that is just going to absorb everything that's around him. Yeah. Oh, I just banged my funny bone. It's just not funny, is it? Banging your funny bone. Oh.
Yeah, there's not. I said to people, yeah, so if people do have questions, obviously drop them in. I said we'd just answer them throughout the show.
Cool.
But yeah, if anyone's got any questions or has put them in already, just drop them in there again and we'll try and get to them throughout the show.
Fire them over to us.
Yeah.
So the main event was kind of odd. I wonder if Imavov hadn't had such a good first round, whether the fight would have been generally more competitive throughout. For me, Dolidze just took such a hit in the first round. He never really seemed to be able to recover. Like, there were a lot of moments where he was holding against the fence and didn't really seem to have a great deal of direction with what he was doing. What I do like are his submission attacks, the scrambles that he uses, the flexibility that he's got as well to be able to pull and drag people into awkward positions. Really, really interesting guy, but just kind of hit a wall with Imavov, who I thought fought a very clever fight. Even though, you know, he fought quite emotional, getting into it with Chris Curtis's team. But yeah, you know, it's the middleweight division for me feels like it's wide open right now. I'm watching this one. I'm watching next week with Joe Pyfer against Hermanson. And I'm thinking like, you could literally Royal Rumble this division. Like, you look at other divisions and you go, okay, right, well, they're the best 2-3 in the division. And lightweight has always seemed like that to me. Yeah, they're the best sort of 2 or 3 in the division. And there's a decent little jump between them and the rest of the division. For me now, middleweight just feels like it's wide open. And I talked about it last week on the podcast. I do still feel, and particularly in the striking ranges, even though he picked up that loss to Strickland, I still do feel like Adesanya sets the standard for striking in the middleweight division. But as it is right now, with Adesanya to the side, Duplessis, Strickland, Imavov, even Dolidze, because you've got to think he's gonna turn things around and come back, and Hermanson and Pyfer and whoever else you want to throw into this mix at middleweight, you could just Royal Rumble it. You know what I mean? Just stick a fold out ladder in the middle of the cage and put the belt on a chain hanging over the arena over the cage. That'd be a great idea. I've got the live stream up now. I have a question. Amberly Rose has a question. Chris Curtis, yeah, I mean, they just kind of generally seem to be a bit of needle between them anyway. You know, like, Chris Curtis gets frustrated because he doesn't get the fight that he wants sometimes, and he's not able to put himself in a position where he can get that fight. You know what I mean? It's like. Like that frustration, when that frustration starts to come out of him, I feel like the fight starts to run away from him, and I think maybe sometimes he feels that frustration for his opponent as well. I don't know. I mean, the thing is, it's like it's Imavov and Chris Curtis. They had the clash of heads, didn't they?
Yeah.
So like that's a fight that probably needs to be made again. But yeah, I don't know. Chris Curtis, for me, like, he was even doing it in the Marc-Andre Barrio fight. He was getting frustrated because Barrio was fighting a smart fight. It's like, well, you know, kind of, I want to walk into range and you stand there. Like, he needs a cage that's, like, 3 feet across. And you can't get frustrated at people playing, like, a smart game. Like, the thing is, if you look at the fight with Chris Curtis and Jack Hermanson and the frustration, like, he was swearing at him after the fight and stuff, and the frustration was that he couldn't close him down like long enough to be able to hit him and hurt him with anything. Whose fault's that? Like, you know, like, if you can't get to your opponent and they're scoring and hitting and hurting you, then, you know, that's kind of the game, you know? Plus, the other thing as well is if you just box, then, you know, you're not giving your opponent other things to think about. Like, the variety sometimes in a person's game is what opens things up. The reason why MMA is so difficult to stay undefeated is because there are so many different ways to lose, you know? Yeah. Okay, any more questions, Jamie?
Yeah, we're getting a couple questions now. Pro Fights Info's got a few questions. Said, what do you think about Molly McCann and Angela Hill next?
Oh, that'd be a good fight. That would be a good fight. Angela Hill is one of those kind of fighters that she's like, she's a tough test for anybody. She's a tough test for anybody. But in recent years, hang on a minute, I can't think and type at the same time. Like, she had that little streak where she started landing elbows clean. Was it? I feel like it was in South America. I went down there. I think I was at that event, and she fought Carnalosi. Where is it? Yeah. She had that little win streak. Jeez, that seems like a long time ago now. My goodness. So yeah, 2019, she fought Ariane Carnalosi and hit her with these mad elbows up against the fence and made a big mess. And then she went into that next fight against Hannah Cyphers and did the same thing, and then fought Loma and beat her by decision. Like, at that point, I thought to myself, you know what? Angela Hill's just found that. She's found that groove, like I was talking about with Joe Pyfer and a few other fighters. Oh, that was the war room, wasn't it? I was talking about that. She's always going to be a tough test. She's like literally 50-50 when it comes to fights going the distance. She's won 11 and lost 11 by decision. She has 5 stoppages, and she's been subbed twice. But she's never won by submission. She's never lost by a knockout or TKO. That would be a really, really good fight. She's also coming off a win over Denise Gomes as well. So, I like that fight. That's a good suggestion. I'm excited for Molly McCann. I just feel like that version of her can be problems for anybody in this division. Yeah.
Michael's MMA talks. Do you think a fight ending in an eye poke like the Muradov Kizriev should be a no decision or a win for the person who got fouled?
It's a really difficult situation because there are a lot of fighters that don't intend on poking their opponent in the eyes. That, you know, it's like no one's intending on doing that. Sometimes it's out of carelessness. Sometimes it's out of habit. You've got to remember, a lot of fighters, they spar in boxing gloves. So in circumstances when they're sparring in boxing gloves and their opponent runs at them and they post, what they're doing with their hand inside the boxing glove is irrelevant because the fingers are covered. As soon as they take that boxing glove off and put gloves on where their fingers are exposed and they do the same thing, then it becomes problematic. There are a lot of times when people are... I remember cornering Adam Amasinger, and something that I am a big fan of when I'm throwing a low kick to the lead leg is to tie up the back wrist. So as I'm dropping over for the kick, I'll twist and I'll put my hand or my arm across my opponent's guard, particularly towards their backhand, just to make the space a bit safer for me to move into. And Adam did the same thing, correct technique, etc. But as he did it, because he was used to wearing boxing gloves, he caught his opponent in the eye completely unintentionally, and it does happen. I will say, though, that if the punishments were more stringent, I do feel like it would happen less. And I feel like if they fixed the gloves, it would happen even less again. What I'll do next week for Aftermath is I'll get a whole mess of gloves out on the table, and I'll kind of show you, because I've got pretty much all the gloves. I've got the Rising and the UFC and Bellator and PFL, and I've got a whole selection of gloves from all the big organizations as well as, you know, some of the smaller ones. And some of them are doing really interesting things with their gloves, like what's the Chinese promotion? They've done this kind of weird thing where there's like a padding to cover the thumb, but the thumb doesn't go in it. I'll show you. Art of War. There we go. For me, still the best gloves on the market are Fairtex. And I have no affiliation to Fairtex. It's purely because they are the gloves that I feel fit my fist the best when I'm punching somebody else in the face. I had my own pair of Fairtex gloves, and if I was going to events and I didn't know whether they were going to have gloves for me to use, I would always have a pair of Fairtex with me because they were the most comfortable. The most compact, they were nicely rounded, they kept my fist closed. I didn't have to fight against them to open my hands necessarily, but they weren't pulling my hands open. And like I said, I mean, I've got a load of different versions of UFC gloves, from the old ones that didn't have the Velcro across that you had to slide in, all the way up to the newest versions. And it's pretty much the same thing. Like the cutout piece of padding, I don't think it's been changed ever. I think, you know, ever since this model of gloves has been used, I think the standard has been pretty much the same. I don't think they are the right glove for this modern day of mixed martial arts. I think people are not quite fully adapted to fighting without big gloves on. And I think that we're seeing that from that and the combination of the gloves not being a fantastic design. We could do a study on it. I mean, there are enough fights. We could probably, there's someone out there that could probably do a study in this and tell us which gloves create the most eye pokes. But from my personal experience, honestly, like, we see a lot of eye pokes in the UFC and we don't see them nearly as much in other organizations. And it's unfortunate. And the thing is as well, I'm sure there's a reason why they haven't changed that design of glove. I'm sure there's a reason. I don't know what it is. My main focus is to make sure that all fighters retire at the end of their career with two eyeballs, and that doesn't always happen. But when you think of even if you think about it from a business perspective, like, look at that fight against Muradov and Hizriev, right? The fight was, 11 seconds in. I was very excited about it. You were very excited about it. Muradov is a killer. Hizriev is a killer. We got 11 seconds. Both fighters got their show money because it was a no contest. And the UFC is probably, $30,000-$40,000 lighter, and we were all robbed of a fight. And you know, I feel like maybe not that particular fight could have been saved by fixing the gloves, but certainly I feel like we could have had a few fights that would have been, wouldn't have ended the way they did, certainly. That's for sure. Give me another sip. You love this class, don't you? Come on, let the Outlaw Rum Dagger on. I've got an Outlaw Rum Dagger as well, Jamie. I'm not even showing anybody that. Oh, it's like Damascus steel, like the actual dagger.
Oh, sick.
Because I did a photo shoot a little while ago. Veronica and I went up to their little secret distillery up in Scotland, which is very, very cool. Like, freezing cold in there, and it was like you could just see your breath, and I'm standing there with this rum, keeping myself warm with a little sip every now and then. And Jim, the guy that owns Outlaw Rum, he was like, check out this knife. And he pulled out this Damascus steel knife and stuck it in the top of a barrel like a pirate. And I'm like, dude, that is a really, really nice knife. I've got a bit of a thing about blades. They're all over the house. Anyway, he bought me one for my birthday. So thank you very much, Jim, and cheers to everybody out there. Any more questions, Jamie? I'm just kind of rambling on. You get a maddest version of me on a Sunday. You don't really probably realise this. I'm far more gathered on a Monday morning. Like, when tomorrow rolls around, I won't be this much of a mess. You know what I mean? Like, this is like I'm on fumes now. This is the chaos from watching 150 fights this week and feeling like my brain's going to fall out. But I do very much appreciate you all joining me. I do love having these chats with you. Wooey, is that how you say? W00EY Onyx. Yes, I have. I have tried Trevor Whitman's gloves. I actually have a pair of the lace ups and the Velcro ones. I haven't tried his MMA gloves yet. I know he was in conversation with the UFC about them, and if any, like, he would be one of the best people. What I will say, if anybody can get a pair, because I think they've all sold out, Owen Roddy has just released his own pair of gloves. I'll show you those next week as well. They are super duper slick. But yeah, I mean, like, anybody that knows how to throw a punch that's designing a glove gets my attention, because most of the time, most of the gloves I put on feel like it's been designed by someone that has never even punched anything in their life. So I always do the test. Like, I put one boxing glove on, and you do this as well, especially if you're an MMA fighter and you're looking for a pair of boxing gloves. Put one glove on, and then I want you to picture what your hand looks like inside that glove, right? Because I want to be as close to a fist as possible inside that glove. Now, of course, with all the other junk and all the other stuff in there, generally, my fist is like that. You'll see some gloves and you'll put your hand inside. I won't call the brands out, but you'll end up being like this position. So, like, you're not even punching in an anatomically logical position. So whenever you're putting your hands inside a pair of gloves, make sure that you can get your wrist and the back of your hand as straight as possible, and that you can close your hand as much as possible. And the one thing that you may struggle with is having something that doesn't pull your thumb out to the side. Like, some of the most expensive gloves in the world, you'll find yourself in this position inside the glove. you're only going to break your hand, especially if you then switch to MMA gloves and think you can do the same thing because you can't. I think the thing is, because I grew up in Taekwondo doing traditional martial arts, we did a lot of stuff like on canvas bags and on like makiwaras, like just conditioning. So because I wasn't blasting it, because I would break my hand, and because I was a kid, so I didn't have the power, I was able to kind of build up the conditioning of my hands. And like, I've never broken either of my hands. I've been very, very lucky. Dislocated fingers, that happens, but my hands have been very lucky. And I think it's because, honestly, I had this conversation with a Ben Willis, a Thai boxing champ, the other day. I think it's because I did so much punching without gloves on before I then crossed over to wraps and gloves. So I was already conscious I was making a... Oh, Veronica's in the chat. I was already conscious I was making a fist before I was punching. And you got to think, a lot of people walk into an MMA gym now and they'll never hit anything without a glove on. They'll go wraps and then gloves, and they never understand how to really fully make a fist. You know what I mean? So this is something, whenever you're shopping for gloves, like be aware of the position that they force your hand into when your hand's inside them. And the reason why I've gone off on that mad tangent is because the reason why the Onyx gloves are really cool is because when you first get the glove, you put a hairdryer inside and you heat it up for a few seconds, and then you put your hand in and you make a fist. And they fit beautifully. They hug your hand really, really nicely. And that's a really innovative way of doing it. And, you know, I think there are lots of other ways as well, but in particular, I thought that was a very clever way that Trevor Whitman's developed the inside of those gloves, intended to be used without wraps, as I think, in my opinion, you know, if you're intending on wearing MMA gloves in your career, you should be able to wear boxing gloves without wraps. And you should be able to learn how to punch correctly and not punch, like, with too much power or too recklessly, where you're going to damage yourself. Oftentimes, when somebody does damage their hands, it's because they've caught an odd angle on someone's head. Like, that's, you know, that's how I've done damage to my thumbs in the past. But yeah, certainly something to think about. I don't necessarily think wraps for MMA fighters are a good thing. Jamie, oh, he's leaned in.
No, Veronica just highlighted a earlier question from Lazy Bed. Thoughts on Themba Garimbo last night?
Yeah.
He said he visualized and manifested his KO in the morning. He wrote it on a slip of paper he carried into the octagon and read it prior to the entering. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
It is interesting. And the thing is, it was nice because right as he got to the checkpoint, he got it out and everyone saw him read it. You know what I mean? So it wasn't like it was, oh, and I've had this piece of paper. You know, everyone saw him go through the process. Yeah, look, it's a fascinating story. And I touch on this a bit in the war room with Joe Pyfer. I feel like sometimes the momentum and the attention on somebody is an additional power pack that they can take into fights. Like that fight could have gone either way. Like, they're both heavy-handed fighters. But the self-belief to be able to open up, throw that right, and it looked like he was level changing underneath it as well. But look, like, we've got to pay attention to him, because like, it's not like he's going, oh, I'm going to be UFC champ one day. Like, he's saying before the end of 2024. And had he not said that in his post-fight interview, he was not going to be fighting for a world title before the end of 2024. In this day and age... He said it now. I have no reason to believe that we might not see him in a welterweight title shot in the future, because these are the kind of storylines that the UFC get behind. You know what I mean? Especially when you've got The Rock. The Rock bought you a house. You know what I mean? Like, if The Rock buys you a house, Dana White can get you a title shot. Come on. That's, you got Rock privilege. You got Dana White privilege. Come on. Like, there's no reason why he wouldn't be able to be getting a title shot before the end of the year, as mad as that is to say. But hey, you just can't predict what's going to happen in MMA these days. Absolutely not. Dan yells a lot as a coach. This is not true at all. Well, I suppose I do yell a lot. I have lost my voice a little bit from yelling yesterday at the gym. I do like a good yell, though. You know what I mean? And what you've got to remember is, and I'm talking I'm talking to everybody as well as specifically my beautiful wife. You're going to war, right? This is why I don't mind corner teams getting into it with like, I don't mind Chris Curtis and Imhoff falling out. And I don't expect any of anybody that I've cornered against to have a pleasant experience with me. Because like, you're at war with one of my teammates, or one of my friends, or in this case scenario, my wife. Like, it, you know what I mean? I'm a different person in that environment. And that's also why you'll notice that whenever I'm cornering, I don't have the mic, because you don't need to hear that version of me. Like, you get this version of me where I'm kind of sitting in my house and having a little beverage, and you know, there you go. Exactly. Caravaggio. He yells because he cares. Exactly. I yell because I care. That's very true. Look, it's a dangerous situation. Like, there are certain circumstances in the past that I wish somebody had yelled at me, and they weren't there to yell at me. So I had to do the yelling myself, and it's always better when someone else is yelling at you. You know, keeps you moving. Horribly mean. Look at this, you know. Well, the good thing is I have a mug in the other room, and it's hand painted, and it says number one coach on it. So whenever Veronica starts giving me shit, I just go, well, I've got the number one coach mug. See, she'll pop up in the comments in a minute and she'll be like, oh yeah, you got me with that one. Lazy bed. Yeah, no, you don't want me as a corner cam. You don't want, I should not be, like, you don't need me on camera. You don't need me mic'd up or anything. Like, Veronica was laughing at me the other day, because we watched her fight back, her last fight, and you can actually hear me at the end of the first round, like, trying to hustle the cameraman into the cage because he was taking his time, and I was in a hurry because I've got 60 seconds and I've got information that I want to impart. And he was like kind of meandering through the cage door. I can't remember what I said now, but it was something along the lines of like, come on, cameraman. But you can, this is why I don't have a mic on when I'm cornering. This is why one of the young brothers has the mic, because they're far more controlled and chilled and, you know. I don't know. And that kind of, wait, now you've mentioned the Herb Dean thing, this kind of circles me back to something else. I think Jamie's going to pull another question up in a second, but because I just scribbled it down on my pad earlier today. Can fighters store more in the Apex? That's a question. In fact, Jamie, you can do one of those poll things, can't you, on this?
Yeah.
Do we get more stalling in the Apex? And I'm going to tell you why I think this is the case. This is my theory. If you're in an arena with 16,000 people and you're 150 rows back and you've had a couple of beers and the fight's slowed down and these guys are dancing around and staring at one another and you're like, at some point you might just decide you're going to go, boo! And then a few people around you might start to join in an arena where you've got 15,000 people, right? Because you could kind of blend in. And although a few people around you might turn and go, this guy's being a dick, he's not appreciating the athletic ability and skill and risk that these guys are taking to step into this octagon and entertain us tonight. He's had a few beers and he's being obnoxious. In an arena, that happens. And people will go, whoa. Like, people are going to be far more self-conscious at the Apex where there's like 300 people there. Think about that. I think we get a lot less booing and jeering from the crowd at the Apex because it's a smaller crowd in a smaller space. I think in a bigger arena, even if it's subconscious, I feel like the referees are going to be prompted a bit more by the crowd to separate the fighters and to you know, break stalling positions. So I'm like, that's something else I'd be interested in knowing. You know what I mean? Like, what's the difference in kind of holding and stalling times? Like, how long does a referee let a fight go in the Apex before they separate it compared to 20,000 seats at a pay-per-view? Because, like, you're just not going to get as many people being kind of rowdy in the Apex. I don't think they serve as much alcohol, and it's a smaller space. Like, what we learned from Fight Island, you can't even yell at the referees in those kind of situations. You know what I mean? Because everyone can hear you. So, you know, like, this is why I feel like the Apex is, like, at certain times, I think it's been a benefit, especially during the pandemic, especially coming out of that, because there were so many people that would, like, they were desperate to get back in there that it was just, like, lock me in a garage with this guy and well, let's go, because they were just desperate to compete. But now I feel like people are either like, well, I'm going to be on the Apex card or I'm going to be in a big arena. And I think fights in a big arena, they're just, there's a different kind of intensity to them. And I'm not sure whether I prefer one over the other, to be honest, because I do think they are different. But certainly the Fight Island experience was very, it's very, very sterile. That's a good way of putting it, because there's not the noise pollution there. And like Fight Island, that, you know, the original arena that they were using in Fight Island, you've got to imagine there were probably about maybe 100 people in the room. Like, there were very, very few. So there's even a lot more people at the Apex, and it's still quite a quiet space. I do wonder whether the fights are, you know, I do wonder whether the crowd noise and the jeering, if the fights start to slow down. Or the waving of the lights, that's a thing now. I don't know where that came from. Yeah, I wonder if fights do tend to get to slow down at the Apex. Even striking outputs, they could probably check that, couldn't they? Like striking outputs from one card to the next. Hmm.
Want to put more of a show on the bigger cards.
Yeah, a good argument towards that, and I, you know, of course, all fighters are different, and I think some fighters will respond differently in different circumstances. But like the very first event where there was no crowd, which was that 2020.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was Brasilia. It was the last fight that Veronica fought on before she took the break. And the main event of that was Johnny Walker against Nikita Krylov. And it was like all the way through fight week, it was like, we're going to have a crowd. We're going to have half a crowd. We're going to have no crowd. We're going to have a few people here and a few people there. It was like, is the show going on? Like all the way through fight week, the ground was shifting. And all the way through fight week, I thought to myself, this doesn't matter at all to Nikita Krylov, because he's just going to come in and do what he does. But then on the other side, you've got Johnny Walker, and Johnny Walker is a performer, especially at this point where he was all flying knockouts and stuff. Like, it was really odd watching him walk out into an arena. It didn't even have any chairs in it. It was like the walkway wasn't even like defined. It was just like walking out into like an aircraft hangar. It was a really odd vibe. And I always thought to myself, I wonder if that fight would have looked at all different had it have been in an arena with a crowd, because Johnny Walker would have probably gone flying at him and potentially been a lot more dangerous. I do wonder.
Because we were there when Habib retired and there was no crowd in Fight Island as well. That was an odd.
Yeah.
Because imagine, like, you know, such an iconic fighter, and it was his last fight to do that.
Weren't Gaethje's parents there as well?
I think so, yeah.
Because it was
they were.
It was like kind of, yeah, it was a very kind of, very intimate space that was. Like I said, I mean, you know, you, like, if you shouted at the top of your voice, everyone in the room could hear you. It was that quiet in there. So, yeah, we'll see. Interesting. 83% of the votes at the moment, although there are only 53 votes. We'll see how the poll goes as the stream goes on.
There's a question from, I had a question from Hashashin. Sorry if I butchered that.
Hashashin.
I know you're going to do a war room for Poirier Saint Denis, but what are your initial thoughts on the bout?
I kind of feel like these are the types of fights where the wisdom and experience of someone like Dustin Poirier shines. Like there's a lot of reasons to be excited for Saint Denis, but it really surprised me that he opened up as the favourite. Like, you've got to think that Poirier of old, the Poirier that fought McGregor the first time was very kind of, very vulnerable in the first sort of 90 seconds of the fight. Like, if someone clipped him in those first 90 seconds, generally they would hurt him. But after he'd settled into that and a couple of minutes in and he starts to relax, you start getting that little shoulder roll that he does. That little shoulder roll, and then he starts stepping into range, square and throwing power punches. He's got a beautiful close range style where he brings his arms and shoulders up to duck underneath punches. And although it can look quite reckless, what we've seen over the years is that it's very, very effective against some of the most dangerous guys around. Like, to be able to wear people down and beat them to the punch and still take some damage, and be able to work through it and create a lot more damage and trauma on your opponent in those kind of fights, for me, it is a very, very valuable thing that Dustin Poirier brings into a fight against someone like Saint-Denis. Because you've got to think, Benoit's coming in to fight Poirier. He's like, yes, this is going to be a war. I'm fighting someone that McGregor fought. I'm fighting someone that, do you know what I mean? And there's like, there's going to be this excitement for him. Whereas for Poirier, it's about staying safe and being smart and keeping winning. I think that wisdom is going to be a big part of that fight. Yeah. Although, yeah, what was been going on? Because he was like, oh, the fight's off, the fight's on, the fight's off. The fight's still on, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's, yeah, there's still a co-main event on 299. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. That's a great card, to be fair. It's looking as good as UFC 300.
Yeah. It will be a banger, but why is Poirier being treated like a gatekeeper? Dan, it's a good question, an unfortunate reality. Is if you hang around for long enough and you're not the champion, then you'll eventually be used to build other people up. It's just, you know, it's the nature of combat sports. And you kind of, like, fighters almost now at this point, they start to expect it. I think Poirier accepting this fight shows that. It's like, well, I'm not hanging on for the you know, the the legendary, still active superstars right now. He recognizes that he's potentially in a position, like Jim Miller realized a long time ago, and Cowboy as well. You know, another good example of someone that's been used to kind of filter and test fighters coming up through the ranks. Same situation I think Poirier is probably now going to find himself in. If he does keep fighting, he's going to end up being that gatekeeper kind of person. And that's not taking anything away from him. If you're a gatekeeper in the top 10 of the UFC, you're a world-class fighter. Like, you know, the gatekeeper, it's a bit of a, I don't know, it's got a bit of a negative connotation to it, because it's like, well, your time's passed, is kind of how it feels. And the reality is, if you're still in the top 10, top 15 in the UFC, your time's certainly not passed. And, you know, you're still holding ground against the best fighters in the world, which shows a level of ability to evolve and adapt against the level that's rising around you. I don't know. I'm a big fan of Poirier, and I think that even though his styles can be quite unorthodox at times, there are lots of things that we can learn about it from an MMA perspective that I think people will start to integrate into their games a bit more consciously. Maybe after the fact. I think people maybe won't fully appreciate what Dustin Poirier is capable of until after his career. I feel like that about a few fighters, to be honest. Corey Sandhagen, another one. I think people really appreciate it now, but I think when we look back on his career after the fact, I think people will go, you know what, he was a chess master in there, in a very chaotic place. Just staying on the gatekeeper thing, I learned something interesting the other day about the phrase journeyman. I think I might have said this on a live stream before, but it's the same kind of thing, right? A gatekeeper and a journeyman. It's got this kind of negative connotation to it. But in actuality, a journeyman was a person that had learned their craft and was now of a level where they could go out on the road with it. Like that's where the term journeyman comes from. So if you're a boxer, if you're a journeyman boxer, you've been in your stable having fights locally for a long period of time. You've learned your craft and you're now considered to have mastered that craft to a point, which means that you're ready to go on the road, to journey and to be the you know, the on the road fighter, which is actually a qualification. It's like not necessarily a quantifiable qualification, but certainly in times gone by, if you were considered a journeyman in boxing, it was a level that you'd attained. So perhaps our perspective has changed a little bit now. Gatekeepers to the title are the top fighters, just as a negative connotation. Tarzan Strickland, thanks for joining us again, my friend. I remember your name from last week. Yeah, it is, I agree, but there's a lot to be learned from these guys, because they have been thriving at the top. I mean, Jim Miller, look at that guy. Been thriving at the top level of the sport for a long time and beating people that, you know, should have overtaken him by now. Oh, is that? Yeah, roadworks, Jamie. Yeah, it is, yeah. What, this time of night? I bet it is. They're digging up the road again. Jeez. Yeah.
It sounds like someone's fan on
heater. Oh, does it? Yeah. You can hear it on the mic, can you? My goodness.
No, I've got one.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, if you can hear any noise, it's not Jamie's stomach. It's it's roadworks. Although what I will say is that the guys on the road today, they were all cool. One of them was like, "Is this where your gym is?" I'm like, "Yeah, yeah, it is. You want to come and see?" It's very cool. I like meeting people. Any more questions? Anything else that stands out, Jim? We've been going for over an hour now.
So I think
people are probably sick of me already.
Well, pro fights info. Just if you don't touch on it, but what's your thoughts? The Hashin's question. Just continuing. What you think about Poirier outmaneuvering the UFC and getting a bag for the fight? So I imagine he's probably getting quite a big paycheck for it.
I bet he is. Yeah, I bet he is. Yeah, and he's deserving of it because you know, like, Dustin Poirier's got one of those names where people will tune in to watch an event because they recognise his name. He's far more of an appeal to casual fans than a lot of other fights on the roster. Those wins over McGregor did big things for his notability, his notoriety. Like, he should be getting paid top money, there's no doubt. But then, you know, I would say anybody that's in Dustin Poirier's position should be getting paid top money, and that would mean that the UFC would probably have to share 20% of their profits instead of 12 or whatever it is. I hope that they keep pushing these amounts up, and I hope with the growth of other organizations as well that the market gets healthier for these fighters to negotiate better purses for themselves. You wouldn't want to think that Poirier would have to retire and rely on the sales of his hot sauce, which is fantastic, I've heard, to keep him afloat. I hope he's getting weighed in, as the term would be. What's the question? How much do my haircuts cost? How much do you think they cost? How much would you pay for me to cut your hair? Because let me tell you, I would charge you a shitload. I would charge you a shitload. And I wouldn't even do a good job. But what I will say is that I have cut so many mohawks in my days, I could probably do it with my eyes closed, both my own mohawks and other people's. I don't feel like you can have a mohawk unless you can cut a mohawk. That's my honest truth. I feel like if you want a mohawk, you should at least make an attempt to cut it yourself. Even if you have to have someone come and shape it up a little bit and tidy it up. You know, it's amazing what you could do with a mirror and a bit of confidence. So, you know, for all those out there spending silly money on haircuts. The only reason I've got this is because I haven't shaved it off yet. And it's coming. It's coming. I'm just, more than anything, and you don't need to know this information, but I'm going to share it anyway. More than anything, I'm just kind of monitoring my slow aging process. Because every day I wake up and I'm like, that's a new grey hair. I had one the other day right in here. And I'm like, I've been looking at too much Dan Strauss Instagram stories because I'm getting a little Dan Strauss cocaine moustache coming right down here. But it's working well for Dan Strauss, the Raspberry Ape. And if you don't know who Dan Strauss is, go and give him a follow. Raspberry Ape on Instagram. He's got the coolest setup for grip strength and strength training that you'll see. I mean, you know, like I love my little gym that I've got here next to the studio, but the amount of variety that Dan Strauss has got, and he always trains in jeans with no shirt on. You know, he's like a proper bloke. Yeah, go and check him out. He's got awesome, really interesting stuff, as well as like grip strength for grappling as well, which I know most of you will benefit from. Yeah. You suspected Dan spent less than Luke Thomas. Luke Thomas always looks sharp. Do not pick on Luke Thomas. He does a fantastic job. Damascus steel knife, raindrop pattern, acid etch. Yeah, you have watched too much Forge in the File. I know the Damascus part, but the rest of it, I'm not exactly sure. I'll show it you next week. Come and join me next week. We'll have a bit of show and tell next week. What else did I say? Gloves. We're going to look at a bunch of MMA gloves. I'm going to show you some Onyx gloves, as well as Owen Roddy's new set of gloves. And I'll show you my Damascus steel knife. I feel like I could just get away with it, honest, Jamie, if I just kind of just bam right in the table here. I know it'll put a little bit of a mark in the table, but, you know, it's actually amazing this table stayed as clean and as unmarked as it has. It's got a couple of red wine stains on it and stuff, but, yeah. If I was a teenager, this would be covered in band logos and graffiti by now, so I'm clearly growing up. All right, I'm just rambling at you now, so I think I'm going to wrap it there. And plus, these boys outside are probably digging up the road again, so I'm going to make sure that they've got a cup of tea in their hand. All right, thanks for joining me. I appreciate you all. Like and subscribe if you feel like it. I'm going to be doing this every Sunday. Every time there's a UFC event, I will be sitting here on the Sunday after having a chat with you guys. So please join us next time. It's been a pleasure talking to you all. Have a wonderful week. Kick ass. Don't take any shit. Don't suffer any fools. Go and own the week. I love you all. See you again soon.